Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. This is PPTS, presented as a service to the progressive community by the Coffee Party USA Radio Network. PPTS highlights the activities, activists, and activism of the progressive movement. Join our host and special guests as we discuss the most interesting and important topics of the day. If you have a cause, an issue, a campaign, or candidacy that you're actively engaged with, please feel free to give us a call at 646-929-2495 and share with us your question or comment. Join the show's co-host and producer, Progressive Patty, in our lively chat. Go to the bottom of this episode page, sign into the chat room, and let us know what you are doing about it. All opinions are welcome. For the Coffee Party USA and Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, welcome to today's show. Please make welcome our host and friend, the Tennessee Progressive.
Well, howdy, neighbor. Come on in. It's cold outside. I mean, it's bad cold outside. And it's only going to get worse for the foreseeable future. Right now outside, the temperature is reading 3 degrees from left and south of Nashville, Tennessee, along the completely frozen Duck River in Columbia, where I will be for the next 2 hours at Tennessee Progressive. We're joined with our team. And we've got listeners that are getting ready to watch a football game. And I'm grateful that you're here with us today. And I hope that we will have information that you will be able to use not only today but tomorrow as well. Today we're going to begin a battlefield that we'll visit again. Of course, we're going to visit all our battlefields again before this talk about the war on the poor is over. And there's going to be a test, so you need to be taking notes today. This is a work session. Imagine yourself to be a member, a newly sworn in member of a state legislature. And you don't even know how to spell legislature. Now you are one. I want you to access however it's possible for you to do so, whether you have a book available to you or you can get online and find it. But I want you to have a copy of the United States Constitution close by. That's going to be a lot of what we talk about today. And the reason for that is because there's an ongoing battle that we as Americans have had to suffer through and witness for the last 5 and a piece years about that very institution itself. Yesterday I had one on my desk and today I can't find it. That's all right. I've got a copy of it online. It's important to know that there was a time when we did not have a constitution. We were, for a little history, A group of colonies deeply divided over what the role of the state and the federal government was. Basically, we were split into two groups that were referred to basically as the Loyalists and the Federalists, which were Loyalists were in favor of the British monarchy and the grace, joy, and wonder of being a British citizen. And the Federalists were those who thought that maybe that wasn't such a cool thing, seeing as how it was a one-way relationship where they were told what they could and could not do. They were charged taxes for goods that actually had been created in their own country, shipped to England, and then shipped back for sale. They thought that was kind of a cheesy thing to do. So while you try to access the documents, I'm going to give you a little bit of breaking news that just came across the wire from the New York Times. It has to do with a movie actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman, has been found deceased in his New York apartment of an apparent drug overdose, according to law enforcement officials, who, interestingly enough, according to the New York Times, requested anonymity because he was not yet certain the actor's family had been informed of the death. Way to go, New York Times. Investigators say they found a syringe in his arm and an envelope containing suspected heroin. It's pretty evident it was an overdose, the official said. The syringe was in his arm. And by 2 p.m., which is an hour ago, hundreds of people have gathered outside the address where the actor was found in a brick apartment building on Bethune Street. Crowd growing by the minute. They said he's a local. He's a fixture in this neighborhood. You see him with his kids in the coffee shop. He's sweet. It's desperately sad. Representative of his production company declined to comment, saying, "I don't have a comment at this time on that. Thank you very much." We mourn the passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman. In other news, there's growing concern about the severe U.S. West drought, and according to all reasonable sources of information, it could be a pretty bad deal before it's over with, and it's not over yet. And over the next couple of weeks, you're going to hear a lot about some constitutional stuff. There's a reason for that, because we're going to start a battlefield on the war on governance. And personally, I think it's fair that we try to go back at least briefly to before the beginning and try to figure out what all this was about and what people were thinking, and why it was that they wanted to do this in the first place. This 238 year later. For the coffee party, it's interesting to note that my friend and fellow co-host, Egberto Willis is considering the same thing. There was a great conversation about why there was a push on both sides of the Loyalists and the Federalists to have their way. And we've got to remember that this is a deeply divided nation already, but it's running under British monarchical law. And on his show, there's been a discussion about capitalism and other forms of worker-owned corporations through collectivization and things like that. And he refers to the Federalist Papers, which we're going to refer to today as well. The reason for that is because those were 85 op-ed pieces, if you would, that from varying viewpoints fleshed out the discussion amongst the people of the colonies. And there are really three of them that we have to deal with. So let's get to it. This comes from the Constitution of the United States and what is generally referred to as the preamble. And the preamble to the Constitution is a really remarkable document in its own right, because it makes known the purpose or the intention of the people. And it says, among other things, that we, the people, and of course there's been a lot of talk about that ever since it was said, but this is one of the most important texts in human history, and it's important to understand that it was on this document that the entire world history turned. Not specifically or uniquely because it was written by the colonists, but because of what was written in it. And I want to go a little bit today into the history enough to say why and how did the document come into existence in the 1780s of all times, and give some information as to how and why it's been amended, to consider what it means, who decides what it means, and what are the ground rules. How does this written document interact with unwritten sources of constitutional authority like judicial decisions and presidential proclamations and signing statements and statutes and popular understandings? Why? Because at the core of it, that's what we're arguing about. That's why. So, we the people, it's kind of important. You see. And if we're to understand this battle for the war on the poor, one of the things we have to understand is that there is at its base, at the very base of all of it, of our legislatures, of our governance, a core founding document . You got to understand that in this time, you had a group of people who had been in convention prior to this constitutional convention in Philadelphia that had created a series of governing documents that were generally referred to as the Articles of Confederation. And what that meant was that the 13 separate colonies had come together to attempt to decide how it was that they would relate to each other and how they would work together in this vast open wasteland. They were all Englishmen. They didn't know exactly how they were going to organize. They had attempted through the Articles of Confederation to establish what basically was a strong state, small federal relationship, where the power of the document was in the states. And like, for instance, they had members of each state to show up at a constitutional or a government convention, which they called a Congress. And if states were busy or, you know, didn't feel like it or didn't want to pay their people to go, they wouldn't. And states were not represented. When it came time to do the business of the convention, states were missing. If the federal government decided that it was going to raise a tax so that it could begin to provide the things that all the states needed, participation was voluntary. And it didn't necessarily lead to the fact that a law being written by this group was going to be interpreted even in the same way by different states. States could just simply ignore them. And as a result, the federal government as an entity became virtually unusable. So that by the time you had the various and sundry uproars over one issue or another, there wasn't a unified body to deal with. I mean, you couldn't have 13, you know, individual legislatures dealing with Congress or the British or whoever it was that they were trying, for instance, to establish relationships diplomatically with. This certainly was not the only problem, and it was not that the Articles of Confederation were in themselves completely problematic, because they did some things that are very important. Why does this matter to me in 2014, bud? Well, if you'll hang in there with me for a moment, I believe that that will become patently clear. May not. The Articles were an idea that were imperfect, but it was an at first attempt to unify the 13 colonies into a representative body of the people. As kind of an experiment to see if it was even physically, geospatially possible for them to represent one another in a unified body. And if the Articles of Confederation were the considered result, the answer to that question would be an unqualified no, we cannot. We can't get along together. States had borders. You had to pay tariff to go across the state line. And that was if you were a white freed man plantation owner in the South. If you weren't, well, that was a whole nother story. But when in 1770, it was determined that the Articles of Confederation were not really doing the job for everybody, there were two things that the people of the colonies had to recognize. First of all, that the Articles of Confederation were not working. Each of the states before and during the Revolution had created their own constitutions. They feature strong state legislatures, weak executives. And in the mid-1770s, the colonies became accustomed to referring to themselves as states. And on November 15th, 1777, at Constitution, the Continental Congress, which was the elected deliberative legislative body for the Federalists, approved a document called the Articles of Confederation, which was ratified by the states on March 1st, 1781. And if you look at that in the scope of history, you may understand that there was a bit of a kerfuffle going on right about then. Now, the Articles did create a federal government, but it was extremely weak, and it did not, in fact, do what it set out to do, which was to represent a national government. There was Congress, but no executive or judicial branches of government. And in this document, we see for the first time the terms United States of America. So, if nothing else, it gave us our name. And the states involved were New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island and Providence Plantation, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. And the first article gave us our name by calling us the United States of America. And then Article 2 goes into the strength of the states who control the executive and the judiciary for their state, as well as their state legislative body, which is not expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. And the Confederation was a league of friendship. It was a unilateral pact of amity, which says we will like each other. Doesn't mean we'll deal with each other or help each other. There was a look toward common defense. There was an idea that the lack of liberty in one state was a lack of liberty among all the states. The hopes of mutual and general welfare, binding themselves to assist each other against all force offered to or attacks made upon them, or any of them, on account of religion, sovereignty, trade, or, quote, any other pretense whatsoever, end quote. And they were working to become a single something. They weren't sure what, but what they wanted was a kind of equality among states. That was kind of hard when you're talking about states as varied as, say, Rhode Island and the Plantation Island, as well as in the state of New York. There's not a lot of things to find in common. So with Article 4, the Confederation started talking about the rights of individuals and free citizens and how they can have, you know, the right to go into or out of any other state, privileges of trade. Against restrictions which shall not extend so far as to, quote, prevent the removal of property imported into any state to any other state of which the owner is an inhabitant, provided also that no imposition, duties of restriction shall be laid by any one state on the property of the United States or either of them. So property became quickly a rule. And people say, well, of course it was. It was white privileged white landowners that created this thing. Well, okay, maybe. I would submit, however, that it was for the contiguous nature of the states to have common borders around which definitions needed to be made. When are we in North Carolina versus when are we in South Carolina, for instance? And what they wanted was equality among the states so that the legislatures didn't have to spend all their time doing one-upmanship and they could go about the business of at least attempting to govern their states. And even the way that members of the Congress were assigned or delegated were differed by each state. And it just became impossible to get anything done. And when you're in the middle of a war and you're trying to generate funds and you're getting loans from foreign nations and you're trying to raise troops and militias and all that sort of stuff, having a man in the commons is one thing. Having him under unified military command is another. So it became desirous amongst those who were involved in the articles that they revised them. And when they met in Philadelphia, that's what they intended to do. They intended to revise the Articles of Confederation. And it became commonly understood that where we had been talking about land, we continue to talk about land, but as a holding place for those who inhabit the land, and we call them citizens, who are the rightful bearers of the land, or the possessors of the land, or the genitors of the land. And there were basically two issues that were bothering folks. First was how many people each state got to send to Congress. I know, let it bless your hearts. That's not exactly what first thing you might think of. But one of the reasons this group came together was because they felt that it was too small a Congress to effectively deal with the needs of all these combined corporations. So what they did was they said, let's come out with a purpose. And it said, we the people. And you get a shift almost immediately from the Articles of Confederation to the document they're working on, because all of a sudden the first three words don't talk about land, they talk about people. And then they use four words to define those people. We the people of the United States. Now, we would learn throughout the course of the preparation of this document that the we the people is not only the most important words in the document, but it's also the most derisive and the most divisive. You have to understand that this is a continuing process, which is the point of all this. It wasn't until the 1960s that the first three words of this document even began to have a shadow of a hope of success. And there are people who have been fighting it since the 1930s. Its preamble says, we the people of the United States. And then give the reasons that they want this separation, that they want this power, that they want this land to be uniquely identified, that they want to be free of foreign tyranny, said, in order to form a more perfect union, which is the one they were leaving under the Articles of Confederation, and to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. And then they say to whom these things would apply. To ourselves and our posterity. You have to understand that at the basis of it, this is a forward-looking document. They understand that if this experiment succeeds through this revolt, that it's likely they're never going to see what it is they're asking for, but they want their posterity to see it. To ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And you've got to remember that at the time these articles were being written, we were really in the throes of a revolution. Okay? We didn't come from nothing. We didn't start from nowhere. We had said that we wanted to have our freedom, and we had made it pretty clear, okay? And it started with some words that were written by one of the delegates in the Confederation, delegate from the Commonwealth of Virginia by the name of Thomas Jefferson, who between June 11th and June 28th, 1776, the Declaration of Our Independence, is an amazing linguistic document to look at from a stylistic standpoint of writing. If you very closely examine the language of the Declaration, the perceptive Declaration as a work of literature and a persuasion, and there's an awful lot of another document in it, which is called the Virginia Declaration of Rights. The first part of the Declaration of Independence can very easily be seen in the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And how are they going to get it out to the states? How are they going to get it to the people? Who's going to do it? How are they going to do it? And all this in the middle of rather significant sadness and uncertainty, because you have to understand that when the king found out that the loyal colonialists were having a bit of a problem and then he months later gets this thing about when in the course of human events he's not what you call happy, because this is his empire, these are his people, and he's not exactly sure. But if he's to read as is written from 11 to 21 June, and then styled as a congressional act on July 4th of 1776, that begins with the United Declaration, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. What you see here is the beginning of the world's largest, most expansive, and most successful corporate merger. who have seemingly, for the purposes of a written document, laid down their differences and their individual issues and all that, to come together and with a sort of apology, we get when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And what they were not talking about was, first of all, they had to separate themselves as individual states with something significantly more than land boundaries doing it. Land doesn't care what you think of it. Land doesn't care what you say to it so much as what you do with it. People, however, are different. And so one people to dissolve the political bands which connected them with another and assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them. They're talking about an understanding that they are losing a little bit of their identification as North Carolinians or Rhode Islanders or New Yorkers or New Jerseyites or whatever it is and become something else. We're going to separate those bonds, and we're going to create new ones. So there's a double play here in the declaration. Now, they say, first of all, what it is that they believe about themselves. And there's a listing of rather restrictive statements, actually, that begin to define a limitation upon the power of documents in this country. That will be the joining of 13 corporations. They say, then we hold these truths to be self-evident, which means they need no further proof. They are of, in and of themselves, apparent among which are that all men are created equal. That was a phrase that darn near put the kibosh on the whole operation. That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are not all truths that are self-evident. These are not all the unalienable rights, but they are representative of the idea of what an unalienable right is: life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And then comes the bombshell that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, not divine birth, not the monarchy of kings and the lines of, lineage of monarchy. That's kind of like the first flinch. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, depriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That the power of government comes from the consent of the governed, which means that the governed must have a lot to do with it. And if then we look at the Constitution, we see that people are kind of taking a whole bunch of declarations and stuff now. July 4th of 1776 was the Declaration of Independence from the colonies, from the crown, head of the monarchy of King George III. Very shortly thereafter, a group of those who, a large portion of whom, had met to create the Articles of Confederation, who had signed Mr. Jefferson's document, the Declaration of Independence, in the previous July, now in May of 1787, to revise the Articles of Confederation. And interestingly enough, a delegation from only two states showed up, so they had to adjourn until such time as a quorum was present for this purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. And in the meantime, they started talking to each other. And long before the words began to be written, there were some ideas that had been floating around the various and sundry states, and they had come up, as men tend to do. They refine their own work over time. And this experiment is still going on. I mean, there's no guarantee now that we've won this thing. We have spent years of bloodletting and all that, and there's still no guarantee that we've won anything. Now, let's skip forward a little bit so that we can get out of Constitution Hall and into the streets, because one of the things you need to understand is that of the original 13 colonies, two of them did not sign this document. Rhode Island and North Carolina refused to sign the Constitution. And the reason they did that was because there were ongoing difficulties and disagreements over two things. First of all, we said, they felt that the size of the legislature established within the document was entirely too small to effect the work that was necessary, as they had learned during the Revolution by the Articles of Confederation, which allotted two people or four people, depending on the state, who elected them. They were not elected, by the way, they were selected to do the business of the nation. That was a real problem. The other was that amongst the several middle states, there had been this generation of what were called bills of rights. And the Constitution did not have these rights. The Constitution was a restrictive document talking about the limitations of the power of the federal government, and spent an awful lot of its time talking about particularly that. Among these issues were how much power to allow the central government, how many representatives in Congress to allow each state, how they should be elected directly or by the state legislatures, and they must have a Bill of Rights. Well, if you're not Virginia or New Jersey, you're not exactly sure, unless I can be in Massachusetts, what a Bill of Rights is. And, of course, North Carolina had problems with the size of the Congress, and Rhode Island had a problem with Bill of Rights. So, as this Constitutional Congress was kicked off, the members kept adjourning from May 14th until May 25th, when seven states created a quorum. Now, the first discussion, by the middle of June, it became apparent that rather than amend the existing articles, the Constitution would draft itself an entirely new frame of government. Now, this is where I said before that this is where the history of the entire world moved. It changed, okay? When they started talking about the form of government that this Constitution would identify, they were talking about a form of government that had not ever existed before in the history of the world. And you have to understand that. When you're talking about The power of the central government of a nation, not a nation state like Greece or Rome. You're talking about a nation of several states. How the representatives in this combined meeting called Congress, which came out of, again, the Articles of Confederation, whether they should be elected directly by the people, appointed by the state legislators or their governors, it's a big freaking deal. Now, you've got to understand that these documents, the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, were written by people who had tremendous differences of opinion with each other. They were generally broken down. If you'll just hold with me a minute, this is going to become painfully clear. You have loyalists who believe that we should not be moving away from the monarchy. In fact, we should be strengthening our ties with the monarchy, which is why we were having the sadness that we were having, because we were bad children acting out in front of our parents. And our parents loved us enough to correct us. That was a generally held belief among others, the loyalists. There were two basic parties, if you want to divide, in the conversation about the Articles of Confederation and the ever-increasing difficulties with the state. And the Federalists believed that it was not only in their best interest, but in their best ability to create for themselves an independent nation that would not be tied to a foreign, untouchable, far-off parent who was charging them for the privilege, but giving them nothing in return for it. And there were those who took that kind of personal and said, we don't believe you should be doing that. Boiled down even further, the Loyalists wanted to stay within the monarchy. The Federalists did not. Now, there's one truth, and about the only truth. As many have stated in congressional, constitutional law, history, and practice, there is one thing about which both sides absolutely agree. This should have your ears perked up and your pens at the ready. All this constitutional stuff was talked about. The Articles of Confederation were being drawn up. Was at the height of everything. That's when the major portion of the British enslavement, according to the Federalist, presence, according to the Loyalist, was going on in the colonies. There was a reason for that that had to do with some expansion going on to the north of the United States and Canada. When, you know, through no fault of their own, the First Nations folks had decided that they were going to go to be on the side of the British, to become loyalists, at least the loyalist sympathizers, because after all, have you seen what America, you know, or these independence colonists have done to our land and to our people? They now had 100 years of practice on that one. So did the British, and the British used it to their best advantage. But there was one thing that had to be absolutely admitted, and that was if you voted as a loyalist, you would never be seen or heard from in American history again. And that really has held true. There were those who at the conclusion, or the what appeared to be was going to be the conclusion of the American Revolution, those who had spoken out against removing the nation from the rule of King George, they became presidents. James Monroe and John Madison leap immediately to mind. So how did that happen? Well, it happened because they fought in the Revolution on the side of the colonists. So while they disagreed with the principle, they fought to sustain it. They fought with Washington, and as the net result was the founding of the country, or at least the removal of King George's influence in the country to some reasonable degree, then they had at least some semblance of victory. And, okay, now what? You know, there's nothing worse than getting what you asked for. Well, there were two sticking points. One was the Bill of Rights, and the other was the representative numbers. But they were meeting in Philadelphia to consider these points. Okay, if we actually are successful, what is this thing going to look like? What are we going to do about it? There were two sides to this issue that were very well represented. You've got to remember that we said we were going to look at some of these op-eds. Okay. Alexander Hamilton wrote the first one in the Federalist Paper number 1. It was a general introduction to the idea. And it talks in the beginning about the Articles of Confederation themselves in non-glowing terms. And there was a relational difference in the document between the Articles of Confederation and the group that was tending to meet at some point in the future to create a constitution. But they had no idea they were going to win. They had no idea that they were going to be able to sever themselves from the crown. They had no idea they would not all be dead. So, in this first Federalist paper, this first op-ed that was going to make the rounds around the country, there were some pretty severe requests made of the people who would read it. And Mr. Hamilton did not mince words. He did not slow down in his statement, and he did not believe that anybody doubted the intent of what he wrote when he wrote, after an unequivocal experience of the inefficiency of the subsisting federal government, "You are called upon to deliberate a new constitution. The subject speaks its own importance, comprehending in its consequences nothing less than the existence of the Union, the safety and security and welfare of the parts of which it is composed, the fate of an empire in many respects, the most interesting in the world." It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country by their conduct and example to decide the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend on their political constitutions on accident and force. If there be any truth in the remark, the crisis at which we are arrived may with propriety be regarded as the era in which that decision is to be made. And a wrong election on the part we shall act may, in this view, deserve to be considered as the general misfortune of mankind. The idea will add the inducements of philanthropy to those of patriotism, to heighten the solicitude which all considerate and good men must feel for the event. And then he says, quote, "Happy will it be if our choice should be directed by a judicious estimate of our true interests, unperplexed and unbiased by considerations not connected with the public good. But this is a thing more ardently to be wished than seriously to be expected. The plan offered for our deliberations affects too many particular interests, innovates upon too many local institutions, not to involve in its discussion a variety of objects foreign to its merits and of views, passions, and prejudices, little favorable to the discovery of truth. Now, this was a direct jab at his Southern partners, of course, and their peculiar institution. But I think the part that Mr. Hamilton brings us is the statement, if there be any truth in the remark, the crisis at which we are arrived may with propriety be regarded as the era in which that decision is to be made, and a wrong election of the part we shall act may, in this view, deserve to be considered as the general misfortune of mankind. These guys knew that what they were about was big business. They knew that it was a big deal. In fact, very shortly, one of the detractors of that view, John Jay, talked about nationalism and the dangers of foreign force and influence for the Independent Journal. So he ties together national security and he ties foreign force and influence, and then he talks about journalism, and he speaks to the people of the state of New York when he says, when the people of America reflect that they are now called upon to decide a question which in its consequences must prove one of the most important that ever engaged their attention, the propriety of their taking a very comprehensive as well as a very serious view of it will be evident. They talk about the necessity of government, and however it is instituted, the people must cede to it some of their natural rights in order to vest it with requisite powers. And that was the problem. What rights would we cede to the federal government to vest it with requisite powers? Should it conduce more to the interest of the people of America that they should, to all general purposes, be one nation under one federal government, or that they should divide themselves into separate confederacies and give to the head of each the same kind of powers which they are advised to place in one national government? It has been the desire and purpose and intent and evidence that the people of the United States, until lately, the prosperity of the people depended on their continuing firmly united in the wishes, prayers, and efforts of our best and wisest citizens have been constantly directed to that object. Yet politicians now appear who insist that this option is erroneous and that instead of looking for the safety and happiness in union, we ought to seek it in a division of the states into distinct confederacies or sovereignties. However extraordinary this new doctrine may appear, it nevertheless has many advocates, and certain characters who were much opposed to it formerly are at present of the number. So these arguments are still going on. Whatever may be the arguments or inducements which have wrought the change in the sentiments and declaration of these gentlemen, it certainly would not be wise in the people at large to adopt new political tenets without fully being convinced that they are founded in truth and sound policy. That is a 1787 slam against the party opposite. You think these guys have got it writing down to a good form? You're talking about an independent America, not composed of detached and distant territories, but that one connected, fertile, widespreading community and country was the portion of our Western Sons of Liberty. Jay loves talking about the Wild West and the Western Sons of Liberty all the way out to old Pennsylvania. Providence has, in a particular manner, blessed it with a variety of soils and productions, watered it with innumerable streams for the delight and accommodation of its inhabitants. Succession of navigable waters form a kind of chain around its borders, as if to bind it together. The most noble rivers in the world, running at convenient distances, present them with highways for the easy communication of friendly aids and the mutual transportation and exchange of the various commodities. You have to remember that river travel was the major source of mass movement of goods and transport in this country at that time. Talking about general liberty individual and company and country independence. He says, with equal pleasure, I have often taken notice that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people. A people descended from the same ancestors, not true, speaking the same language, not true, professing the same religion, not true, attached to the same principles of government, not true, very similar in their manners and customs, absolutely not true, and who by their joint councils, arms, and efforts, fighting side by side throughout a long and bloody war, have nobly established general liberty and independence. Completely true. This country and its people seem to have been made for each other, and it appears as though it was the design of Providence that an inheritance so proper and convenient for a band of brethren, borrowed from Shakespeare's Henry V, we few, we band of brothers, united to each other by the strongest ties, should never be split into a number of unsocial, jealous, and alien sovereignties. So even among the detractors, and this is as far as we'll go today, this is very important to understand that even among the detractors, these first documents, the Constitution through its preamble, which was presented, is less than 8,000 words. So in order to get the information to the people, the document was published in newspapers across the country, up and down the line. And of course, those three words, we the people, were at the top of it. In order to form a more perfect union. In order to form a more perfect union is interesting because that's what's still happening. We are still trying to form a more perfect union. And through our history, we have been trying to find that part that was the more perfect union. What you may not understand yet, but I promise you will shortly after we come back from a break, if you'll just stop and consider what we've talked about so far, it may begin to answer the question, why is it that the greatest damage to democracy in the last decade has been the inability of her citizens simply to talk to one another? Because that's what this is all about. And you can believe me when I tell you, it is purposely planned. So we'll take a little bit of a break. You consider that, come back. We'll have a lot more news and a lot more information for you. I am the Tennessee Progressive, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the completely frozen Duck River on this Sunday, February 2nd, 2014. You stand by. We'll be back. Bye-bye.
Hello everyone, this is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. There are many arguments proclaiming the evils of big government, and it always seems to come back to the same arguments made by the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists during the days of our founders, concerning the differences between a strong central government and a weak central government. The Second Continental College adopted the Articles of Confederation on November 15, 1777, and it was in place until 1789, but it was replaced by the Constitution, which advocated for a stronger central government. Why was it replaced? The Articles of Confederation maintained the principle that the national government would not hold more power than the states, that which they saw as sovereign. This satisfied the fears that many of the states had regarding a strong central power, as Britain was before the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there was no executive branch, because they feared giving one man that much power, and it was decided that the Congress would handle all the nation's affairs. However, there were many inherent weaknesses with the Articles of Confederation. The national government did not have the power to tax. Congress did not have the power to force states to obey its laws. Congress could not enforce laws. Each state could issue its own paper money. Any state could put tariffs on trade between other states or countries. There was no system of national courts. Congress could declare war and raise an army, but it could not force a state to give men or money. After the Revolutionary War, the country went into a deep post-war depression. The states were threatening war with each other, and there were armed uprisings and riots across the land. Things eventually got so bad that the country was on the verge of a civil war. This was called the critical period. Because each state was printing their own money, the value depreciated soon after the war, and many returning soldiers were paid in currency they considered to be worthless. There are stories that some soldiers wallpapered their house with the paper currency. On May 25, 1787, the Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia to decide the fate of the Articles of Confederation, and on September 17, 1787, a new constitution was approved, which had the much-needed, stronger central powers. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Blog Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. The Boston Tea Party is one of the most cherished stories from the founding of our country. This is one of the events that inspired the American colonists to stand up against tyranny imposed on them from the British government. Until 1764, the colonies were allowed self-rule, but with the conclusion of the French and Indian War in 1763, the British were low on money, so they decided to begin enforcing their trade laws to try to increase their capital. The British began to go after smuggling by searching colonial ships and convicting colonists in the British Admiralty courts. This enraged the colonists because the violators weren't given a trial by jury. Also, the British began levying taxes against the colonists on a whole host of articles, as well as tea, from sugar, coffee, stamps, and even dice and playing cards. The British didn't think they were being harsh on the American colonists, but the Americans disagreed. They believed the troops garrisoned in the colonies weren't needed since the French threat had been removed. Why would they want to pay taxes for garrisons that were only there to make sure the American colonists stayed in line? The colonists always received permission in the past from England for levying their own taxes, but now that right was being taken away, and because they didn't have their own representation in the British Parliament, they were being denied their own traditional rights as English subjects. This was going too far. In regards to the Tea Act, the British government gave the East India Company permission to transport tea, duty-free, from Great Britain to America to sell. Because they didn't have to pay the duty, it meant they could undersell the American merchants who sold tea, which would monopolize the tea trade. This would drive many colonists out of work. The Bostonians felt that something had to be done. If they allowed the tea to land and be offloaded, then the British would have had a moral victory in that the colonists were finally paying the tax they created for them. Also, there were many Tories, those still loyal to England, which would have had no problem with buying the tea. Destroying the tea seemed to be their only option. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA blog talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
Welcome back to the Coffee Party Radio Network. This is Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. I am the Tennessee Progressive. I'm joined in studio today with Progressive Patty and Progressive Lindsay, and we're talking about the war for governance, the battle for governance and the war on the poor. The Federalist Papers were an ongoing conversation between the people of the United States, as was directed by particularly in the early papers two people, Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, and there would be another primary contributor later on. The papers 2 through 5 pretty much dealt with concerning dangers of foreign force and influence on the nation should we fail in the enterprise of the revolution. 6 begins a conversation that was really very interesting because it had arisen to the point of being a major concern, and that was the battle between the states. The colonies become states, wanted their own fiefdoms, the kingdoms, the monarchies, the tariffs, the fiefdoms, the pretty much, you know, the articles were dealing with the difference between democracy and monarchy and high station and things like that. So with number 6, the conversation begins with Hamilton talking about a review of the last 3 numbers having been dedicated to an enumeration of the dangers to which we should be exposed in a state of disunion from the arms and arts of foreign nations. And there was an outpouring of dissension among the states. And he talks about more alarming dangers, and that flowing from dissensions between the states themselves and from domestic factions and convulsions. There have already been, in some instances, slightly anticipated, but they deserve a more in full investigation. And they talk about the difference between utopian speculations and the realities that they may be able to face if this revolution is to be successful. And it has to deal with the vagaries of humanity and being human and having a belly button. They list several rivalries and competitions of commerce and stuff like that. Then he goes into a slight history lesson about the Greek state and the Roman state and why it was that a disagreement over two people wound up in what became known in the Grecian annals as the Peloponnesian War. And it terminated in the ruin of the Greek Commonwealth. So he gives that example, and then for the next few Federalist Papers, these op-eds, these insertions into news broadsheets across the country, there was this ongoing nudge, push and pull between concerning dangers of dissension between the states and the consequences of hostilities between the states. And they wanted to talk about several broken up sovereign nations within the states. That was their, it was in Federalist Paper number 8 under Hamilton that we first saw the terms war between the states. That would come back to visit us later and hear things to talk about, plunder and standing armies and things like that. If we are wise enough to preserve the Union, he said, we may enjoy an advantage similar to that of an insulated situation. Europe is at a great distance. Our colonies in our vicinity will be likely to continue too much disproportioned in strength to be able to give us any dangerous annoyance. Extensive military establishments cannot in this position be necessary to our security. But if we should be disunited, and the integral parts should either remain separated or, which is most probable, should be thrown together in two or three confederacies, we should be in a short course of time in the same predicament of the continental powers of Europe. Our liberties would be prey to the means of defending ourselves against the ambitions and jealousies of each other. And then we get a union as a safeguard against domestic factions and insurrection. The purpose of the union was to make sure that that didn't happen. And the more powerful was written on Friday, November 23rd, 1787, by an introduction as a first article by James Madison. And it starts, these were printed across the country, but they were printed as a statement to the people of the state of New York, because among other things, there were more people in the state of New York than any other state. And also gotten an agreement to publish these papers in a New York newspaper that would broadcast them across the nation. And this is a very serious consideration because it had to do with the causes and effects of factions. It was impossible for them in this revolution to understand why there would be a factions of, you know, commerce or boundary lines or anything else at the time we were fighting to become an independent nation. So I recommend Federalist Papers 1, 2, and 10 to you in particular because it is a lens into the time as it was happening that very seriously deal with the possibilities of what could be the case with an independent nation versus the loss of the war in a subjugated nation to everything from northern enemies to western enemies to southern enemies to the French, who, by the way, were at this time very actively involved, having learned lessons of democracy even perhaps better than we had ourselves at that point. And when on July 14th, 1789, they had their French Revolution, one of the things that came out of it was the most democratic nation probably, absolutely, in Europe and possibly in history. Well, what's all this about? There were people at the time the Declaration, the Constitution was written, who violently disagreed with each other. Because of the Articles of Confederation, not only were they allowed their voice, but they were allowed to disregard anything which they didn't particularly care for. There was dissension within the Union, and the Union was just a vapor. It didn't exist yet, and it wouldn't exist for several years. The war would actually continue with small moments of dispensation into the War of 1812. When again the British decided that they were going to deal with these upstart Americans, and there was some concern about the Americans invading Canada, and the British wanted some of their territory back, and the Indian First Nations had decided that they were going to side with Canada because they didn't feel like they were being equally represented or fairly represented by the United States, so they became aligned with an enemy of the United States, which would unfortunately have some serious repercussions later on. And that repercussion would continue as the expansion west until we got to, say, the boundaries of the area that would become known as Missouri Territory, Kansas Territory, Louisiana Purchase. Even as the states were trying to figure out how to assemble in a representative government with a larger people's house, lower house that we call the House of Representatives, and a more static Senate to provide the legislature, we had established a president who was basically a chief constable. He was a chief magistrate, and there was a lot of talk about what he should be called and how he should be operating and all that. And that would be firmed out in the Constitution. But the other part of the Constitution, which was really the holdout that made Rhode Island and North Carolina not sign the original Constitution agreement, were these two issues. It was the Bill of Rights and the representational body of the House of Representatives. So when the Constitution was finally ratified, the very first thing that happened was, when they first met, the first thing they did was they proposed a Bill of Rights. They said, "We have heard your complaint. We understand your concerns about the form of the legislature," and we very quickly found out that the rule that said a minimum of one and a maximum of seven representatives for each state is not really workable. So instead of doing it on a land basis, we'll do it on a population basis and say that one in 30,000 is fine for now, with the understanding that we can grow it as it is needed. Now, about these Bill of Rights, about these rights we're talking about. The differences became apparent very quickly between the culture of the North and the culture of the Southern states. Unabated from the War of 1812, unabated from the Constitution itself and the Constitutional Convention, which gave us the document that was then ratified by 9 of the 13 states, these issues would continue. They weren't going to go away. And unfortunately, they were not going to go away to such a degree that it would come to be that these dissensions that were talked about by Madison and Jay and Hamilton would be visited upon the American people in the late 1850s. And in the course of the dissension, there were like holdover resentments from the Revolution, actually. It's only been 70 years. There are plenty of people who had lived that war. So how was it that James Monroe, who was a staunch monarchist, a loyalist, came to be president of the United States? The answer was that in his disagreement, he fought beside General Washington in the Continental Army. I disagree with the idea, but that's how. In their disagreement, they found union. And they agreed that the differences that they had were significant enough that they would work them out in time. But for right now, if they didn't win the revolution, none of it mattered. While they had an eye to the future, they also were grounded in the reality of the present. They knew what was at stake. The states were trying to spend their time in their legislatures raising militia and participating. Now, there's no doubt that Rhode Island and North Carolina participated in the revolution. And when it came to be that these things were not going to go away. One of them was slavery. One of them had to do with, many of them had to do, along with slavery, with economic rights and a feeling among some of the states that slavery itself was either wrong or correct. I mean, there were voting members of freemen's, you know, that were free slaves. That's sort of like an oxymoron, but freed slaves who voted for the Constitution. And there was a difference of pictures between what was going on economically in the South to support the North and what was going on in the North to support the South, where the commercial and agricultural centers were versus the industrial centers and all that, that as we moved west, those arguments sort of went with them. To the point that presidents had said these and no further, or there were issues about, well, if you want to have slavery in this state, every state should be able to decide. Came Kansas, came Missouri Compromise, came Louisiana Purchase, and the federal government said, we will not extend slavery into these states after they had said the states could decide. Again, states disunioning, dissenting, creating disunion because they still did not understand the concept of democracy. Territories were being established, explorations were going on, the federal government was paying the cost, defending the troops, defending the explorers going west. It was a continuation of the experiment that had started before Lexington and Concord. Unfortunately, I think the Republican president, 16th president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, was assassinated. I believe that if President Lincoln had lived to serve in a second term, we would never have had to have a march on Selma. I believe that the 13th through the 16th, 17th Amendments would not be necessary. That's what I believe. But we can argue what history might have been, but we do know what history is. And the thing I want you to understand is that the experiment is not over. The experiment is still going on, and in many ways we are still having the same disagreements. The only difference is now we have people injecting their desires into the process with money. That while we're sitting back not being citizen and engaging in discourse about what we should do moving into the 21st century to bring this document with us, to understand that it is our best intent to keep this document, to keep democracy, to understand that we all have a role to play and that every side has a legitimate point of view that needs to be heard, which, by the way, is the big difference. Democracy fails. There are those that want democracy to fail. It is not through altruistic national principles. It's for profit. If you believe that spending $100 million in a campaign is for the purpose of national unity, I'd like to talk to you at 646-929-2495. Understanding the documents that brought us here, that keep us going. You know, people question things like, does the president have this power or that power? Can Congress uniformly decide that for 7-8 years it's going to do nothing? Do the people have an obligation to hold their electeds accountable for what they do or don't do? Is it impossible for differing sides to speak to each other? These are the things that we have to come to understand, because things are happening around us. And we're going to hear a lot about that this week and next week as we begin a push to have citizens actively involved in a particular process that we're going to be highlighting on this show. And it deals with the Supreme Court of the United States coming out with a decision this month, we believe, in the McCutcheon case. And I would invite you to study up a little bit on the McCutcheon case to find out what the issues are, because we're going to have some folks on our show next week. They're going to talk about it a lot. And in this battle for governance, they're going to pinpoint us not only on what the issues are, but they're going to take us to a point of action where we can do something about it. And I would like you to be aware of that, to be ready for that, and to be listening, especially next week when the Coffee Party and PPTS are going to host the directors of Public Citizen and some other organizations who are going to talk about an action that you can take on the day that the Supreme Court announces its decision in the McCutcheon case. You should be thinking about that now. And you can go to publiccitizen.org or to moveon.org. And for the purposes of transparency and clarification, I am a member of the national support team for moveon.org. There are a number of organizations that are working together in unison to create a citizen response to the Supreme Court's decision in McCutcheon. And we believe, I believe, that it is imperative that the Supreme Court overturn McCutcheon and Citizens United, which is the grounding case of money in politics. And this show, this network, Move to Amend, Public Citizen, all kinds of different activities are working very hard to get money out of politics. And some have proposed, like Move to Amend, a constitutional amendment, which is making its way through the House of Representatives right now, and making it imperative that we as citizens participate in this process. You know, we talk about the executive, we talk about the legislative, we talk about the judicial, but we don't talk about the fourth estate. The fourth estate is generally referred to as journalism, but what it is the voice of the people. And I'm not particularly caring whether you are a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian or a Green Party member or a socialist or a communist or anything. I want to talk to you as citizens. Are you willing to sell your right to democracy with the understanding that the easiest way and the most effective way to do that is through your silence? It is time for us to recognize that we are in very large part the reason that our government has been the way it has for the last few years. And I am encouraging you to do your homework, to come to this show, to listen to the people that are going to be talking to us over the next week or two, to plan to get together with a couple of your friends, talk this over, and decide that you're going to show up and show off on the day that the McCutcheon decision comes down from the court, to apply the pressure before with letters to the editor or, you know, however you see that in a home meeting, whatever, and decide that you are going to vocalize your opinion on this matter. I don't even care what your opinion is. I care that you stand up, come together in a public place, and state your opinion. So it's a thought experiment in democracy. It's a plan that is being run by 50 state organizations in multiple layers. But the first one is, think about it. If we believe that not only is money speech and that corporations are people, you also have to understand that McCutcheon says there's no limit to that. There's no limit to the amount of money. There's no requirement for donor designation, that it's wide open. It's robber baron days all over again. This is a battle for the governance of our country because there are those who want to buy it. There are those who want to say that it's okay to pollute the aquifer and the Ogallala aquifer to create multiple streams of disaster for the American people without regard, that we believe as American people that it doesn't matter what we do to our land, our air, our water, that anything for the right price is okay, and the difference between those with the money to purchase this government and everybody else is okay. I happen to disagree with that notion. We, the people, in order to form a more perfect union, it's not perfect yet. The experiment continues. And there are those who have a particular belief that are opposed to mine, opposed to, I think, most citizens of this country, that say that their money should buy their government. Now, we've been saying that money has corrupted government for a long time. Here's a way to begin to reverse that process. No citizen should have more of a right than any other citizen. That we as citizens are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which, not exclusively are which, life. Life in a safe environment, a safe community, where we don't have to lock down our kids in bathtubs at night, where we don't have to fear going out at night, where the corporations that serve our communities are on a social contract and agreement of how they will perform and participate in the communities they serve, that they will work to a public good and not to the shareholders of the corporation for profit. You can begin to make a statement today. All you have to do is get on to Google and look at, just Google McCutcheon, and look at the Supreme Court case and see what it is that the court is trying to decide about the power of money in America. It's that simple. Now, my question to you is, having the faith in you that this is going to happen, will you do something about it? We've been asking you to have civil discourse. The coffee party is 4 year old this month, and I want to wish Annabelle and Eric and all the folks at Coffee Party who have brought us into the realm, who have believed in this show and what it is that we're trying to do, to the point that they have offered us space to be part of the leadership team of this party, to understand that we are about discourse. There is soon to be a new documentary out that is being finalized now. You can go to storyofamerica.org. And you can offer your story of America. And you can find out a little bit about what's going on with the documentary that the Coffee Party through Annabelle and Eric are doing. You can donate to that cause. They need your help that way because they're trying to get it in post-final. And that's, of course, the most expensive part of any film presentation. It's the final preparation. You know, as a writer, it's not difficult for me to write words, but it's terribly difficult for me to format them in a way that you can read them. And that's what they're trying to do with the film. So I encourage you to go to coffeepartyusa.com, to storyofamerica.org, to look at some of the stories that have been posted there, to give you the opportunity to tell your story of America and what you think America should become, and then help the conversation continue in civil discourse about those things which matter most to us as Americans. I have to tell you that it's going to ramp up. Any of that know this show over the last 2 years know that we continually add to a purpose, and the purpose and the outcome is always the same. It's no big surprise. The question is, what are you going to do about it? We don't believe that disunion among the states is the way to do it. We don't believe in severing one part of the country away from the other, that we are 50 states. We believe and understand through political process and precedent law that there is no such thing as a right to secession, no more than there is a right to suppress your vote. And we talk about the ways that these things have become apparent. That's what these battlefields are. That's why these battlefields exist. That's why this war exists. And you can disagree, but you don't have to be disagreeable. And we invite you on this show at any time to tell us your opinion, what you think about something. And thank goodness we have listeners that do that on a regular basis, and we appreciate you. This show is also related to Netroots Radio, and we'll be having this conversation for the next two shows on Netroots. This show will be replayed on Thursday night beginning at 9 p.m. Pacific time or midnight Eastern time on netrootsradio.com. And we want to touch as many people as possible to get you the opportunity to participate in your governance in the role that is appropriate and right for you to do so. So we want to have a national response from the citizens of this nation to the outcome of the Supreme Court case either way. And there are organizations that are set up to do that. Move On is, Public Citizen is, many others. Move to Amend is. And it's going to be real important for us all to understand that even as we deal with the realities of life, I mean, here it's an Arctic blast. It's coming down to nothing, and people are lining up to go to the store and get their stuff out of, you know, so they can be safe, and they'll probably buy the pretzels and whatnot, pop to pizza, and watch what hopes to be a superb football game tonight. But at the same time, I want you to understand this is a challenge I'm offering you, that I'm putting out to you, to become informed, to become aware, and to become prepared to do something about this thing. I look forward to it, and I think it's going to be important for us to understand that we have not only the obligation, but we also have the privilege of being citizens. And that is something that no one but us can take away from us. So maybe we're out of practice. Maybe we don't know what the Constitution's preamble means. Maybe we don't understand the arguments that made this experiment possible to begin that has yet to end. One sentence, we the people, doesn't say we the corporates, we the corporation. It doesn't say we the business interests. It doesn't even say we the political parties or the PACs or the fund managers or anybody else. We the people, the citizens of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, which is what our goal, the purpose of this document is to create a more perfect union. And to form a more perfect union, we establish justice. We want to ensure domestic tranquility. We want to provide for the common defense. And we want to promote the general welfare, the welfare of all the people. We want to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves, to be sure, but also to our posterity. Is that any less true today than it was in 1787? Isn't it true that American adults today who are parents want to leave this country and this world to a better end for their children? Therefore, we do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. This is a living document. It's a breathing document that matters to us all today. It's the longest running experiment in democracy in the world's history. It turned the entire world's understanding of governance on its head. In the middle of our revolution, another revolution began that created another democracy that turned the world again on its head. It is our Constitution that began the French Revolution. The ideas that that Constitution entailed, from our Declaration of Independence through our Bill of Rights, the ongoing amendments to the Constitution, which have updated and refreshed the Constitution to not only clarify what the Constitution originally was intended to do, but to bring it into form with the current living of people. You know, the Constitution has nothing to say about the Internet, regardless of the fact that we know that if it's true, if it's on the Internet, it's true because Abraham Lincoln said so. I messed that one up, didn't I? Oh, well. The idea is that we have things to deal with in a country today that were not visible. The power of the Constitution, the Declaration, the Bill of Rights, and the amendments is that they can expand or contract. Sometimes they contract to bring our documents into form with our living. But we as citizens have to discuss what it is that we intend by living so that we can make the appropriate changes, if necessary, to the Constitution or those other documents in such a way that they will support us in the 21st century. The unwritten document of the Constitution is so much stronger than the written document. The document itself is a framework. It's a skeleton upon which democracy hangs. We put the meat and the clothes on it to look like us. We can do that in the 21st century, too. You can begin to rev up your, you know, I'm a citizen exercises by understanding that there's a place coming soon that you can speak out and join together and just stand there and say, yay or nay. We want you to do that across this country. So if you're willing to do this, it's just an experiment. It's an experiment in constitutionality. It's an experiment in democracy. It doesn't require party affiliation. All it requires is you to be citizen. That's why I have agreed to participate at a national level, at a local level, and to present those with an opinion on it. I hope that you have an opinion on it. I hope that you will do something about it, and I hope that you'll listen closely and join us as we do this. Coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Frozen Duck River, go Broncos. I have been the Tennessee Progressive. Please be careful, be safe, check on your neighbors, make sure your pets have fresh frozen water, and be kind to each other this week. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye for now.
Hi, this is Dan Aronson, and you're listening to Press One for Democracy, heard here every Monday night on Coffee Party Radio starting at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Did you know that there's an entire lineup of Coffee Party Radio shows that airs each week? On Thursdays, our executive director, Janine Loudon, hosts Lunch with Loudon, starting at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Saturdays, Egberto Willis hosts Politics Done Right, starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the newest edition of our Coffee Party Radio family joins us on Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's Bud Fields with Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. And remember, unlike our current federal government, Coffee Party Radio is of the people, by the people, and for the people. Each show, you'll have the chance to call in at area code 646-929-2495 so you can stand up and be heard. When you can't make it with us... Hi, this is Dan Aronson, host of Coffee Party Radio's Press One for Democracy. Did you know that there's an entire lineup of Coffee Party Radio shows? We at P1FD kick off each broadcast week Mondays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Thursdays, our executive director, Janine Loudon, hosts Lunch with Loudon, starting at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Saturdays, Egberto Willis hosts Politics Done Right, starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the latest addition to our Coffee Party Radio family joins us every Sunday at 4 p.m. It's Progressive Politics Tennessee Style with your host, Bud Fields. And remember, unlike our current federal government, Coffee Party Radio is of the people, by the people, and for the people. Each show, you'll have the chance to call in at area code 646-929-2495 so you can stand up and be heard. When you can't make it with us live, remember that all of our shows are available to you 24/7 in our online archives. So again, this is Dan Aronson on behalf of all Coffee Party Radio hosts and our entire membership, saying thanks for joining us to discuss the issues of the day, the Coffee Party way.